So welcome. Thanks for coming in today. Can you hear me? Can people hear me? No. Up. I may just have to stand up and yell like I do when I teach class. It's fun to yell at students. You didn't hear that, students. Yeah. All right. How about now? Better? Okay. Well, welcome again. My name is Chip Stewart. I'm a professor at TCU, a recovering lawyer and journalist. I guess I'm still kind of a journalist. I edit a magazine, after all. I've got some wonderful panelists here I want to introduce to you. This panel, Intellectual Property Issues and Social Media, the idea came up last year. I came down to the conference, and one of my colleagues who could not be here this year said, hey, you ought to do a panel on law stuff. There's never good panels about law stuff, or we don't see a whole lot. And I thought, oh, that sounds like a wonderful idea. And I'd been doing a little bit of research on this area anyway, and so I started to put together a panel and realized I'd better surround myself with people smarter than me. So I did, thankfully, got these folks to join up. So with me I have Kathy Olson, who's a professor at Lehigh University, also an attorney. She used to work here at the American Statesman and helped to launch their webpage back when people did such things. Next to her is Tori Ekstrand from Bowling Green State University, a professor who specializes in hot news doctrine, free culture, and other copyright issues. And next to her is Riyad Omar, who's VP and Principal Legal Officer for Newsright, and former General Counsel at Associated Press. How we're going to do this today, we're each going to talk about 5 minutes on our topics, and then 5 to 6 minutes, if we get a little over that happens. I really want to leave the last 20 or 30 minutes open to questions from you. There is so much intellectual property law that we couldn't cover it in 3 days, much less an hour, so we're going to do the best we can to cover the hottest topics that are out there. With that, I'd like to go ahead and get started. Oh, a couple of other things. Our hashtag is South by IPSM, so SXIPSM. There's no and symbol in there that was in the guide because that, as you know, doesn't work very well in hashtags. Also, all of our notes and outlines I put up on a Tumblr page, ipsm.tumblr, if you want to go check those things out. And all our Twitter accounts are on there. But before I get into kind of general journalism and mass comm problems with intellectual property, I want to talk about one of my own problems, which is that I have another Twitter. Actually, I have a couple. One I use to talk about my kids' soccer games. You don't want to follow that one. Another one you probably don't want to follow is to gripe about the Texas Rangers. I'm a long-suffering Texas Rangers fan. And so I use this avatar. I'm the Texas Rangers, use this avatar of Texas Rangers with bags on their heads. This is my life outside of teaching journalism and law and that sort of thing. You see, I'm pretty big. I've got 86 followers, and most of them are spam. One of my former students tweeted me, he texted me this picture that he found in a book, and I copied it and put it. I thought, that is terrific. That so much sums up what I am as a Texas Rangers fan, 1970s uniforms and bags on their heads. And so I just generally use this. I'm a lawyer. I know copyright law. I don't have a license to this. I didn't ask permission for it. It is certainly within copyright. So I may very well be infringing on here using this as my avatar. So you can't see my little letters on there. So is the photo of the use of this photo, is it fair use? Is it piracy? Is it none of the above? Kathy, am I a pirate for using this photo?
Well, Chip, I'm going to give you the straightforward legal answer, which is that it depends. I think it's
we like that answer.
An interesting question, though, because it really points out some of the gray areas between copyright law as it's written and some of the informal rules of common practice in sort of the real world. The formal rules of copyright, they also contain built-in safeguards to protect free speech, free use, and free expression. When we talk about social media use, we often talk about it in two different ways. Creation, sharing original works, and curation, sharing the works of others. And copyright really was built to protect both kinds of uses. Copyright gives a certain monopoly rights to creators in order to encourage the creation of works and it limits those rights to preserve the public domain and to allow others to use and build on those works. So copyright helps protect free speech in a number of ways. It requires a minimal level of creativity in order to have copyright attach. So copyright protects, of course, the expression of an idea, but not the underlying idea itself. And it doesn't give protection to facts. So talking about a tweet then, tweets are generally not copyrightable. They don't have copyright protection, and that's generally a function of length. 140 characters just doesn't give you the chance to express something with a sufficient level of originality to be copyrightable. It's not impossible, of course. As we know, size isn't everything. Something like a haiku can be highly creative and therefore copyrightable, even though it's very short. But generally speaking, tweets aren't copyrightable. Even Mark Cuban's tweets ranting about the referees at the last Dallas Mavericks game, even if he wants them to be.
And he's right, by the way. move ahead.
Other things on social media, of course, photos on Pinterest or TwitPic, videos, news stories, are generally types of things that are protected by copyright, but the scope of protection is limited, again, in ways that are meant to serve the public interest. One way is by limiting the length of the copyright term, and one of the main ways is, of course, with the fair use doctrine. Fair use helps preserve that balance between rights and the public interest by protecting certain uses that are seen as socially beneficial and protecting those uses from infringement claims. Courts will examine and weigh each of the four factors in order to determine whether a use of a copyrighted work is protected. And fair use is really meant to be very flexible based on the specific facts and the equities in each particular case. Some of the protected purposes written into the statute include comment and criticism, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research, but even those aren't definitive. Also not definitive is whether your use is commercial or not. You can make money by using somebody's copyrighted work, and it may still be fair use. More and more what courts look at is whether your use is transformative. Are you using the work to create something new? This idea of transformativeness lately has been extended to include even just a productive use that uses the original in a different way or for a different purpose. What matters is if you're substituting your copy for the original. If you're repurposing it or if you're otherwise giving it some sort of different use, it may be considered transformative. So things like mashups, parodies, sharing a video, and commenting on it may all be protected uses. Just copying something is generally not enough. At the same time, of course, on social media, what's being copied is often also being commented on, even if it's just to make fun of it or to say, I like this particular thing. It's not clear exactly how much you need a commentary for it to be considered comment and criticism under fair use, but it certainly doesn't have to be weighty or serious commentary to be considered fair use. The first factor ties in with the other factors, too, in that the amount that's used of the original depends on what you're using it for. In some cases, it may mean just a snippet of, you know, a news article with a link to the whole thing. But sometimes you may need to copy the whole thing. And that's often true with photographs, for example. And that may still be fair use, even though you've taken the entire thing. The fourth factor for the effect on the market is as important as the first because it helps balance the beneficial use of the work with the harm that it may cause the copyright owner. On social media, this factor highlights the difference between curation and aggregation. That is, curation implying you're selecting and commenting on the things that you're copying and that you may do it occasionally and for a different purpose, rather than aggregation, which implies you're copying the same things every day for the same purpose as the original, which would tend to affect the market for the original. Taking a look at Pinterest, the photos, this has been the object of a lot of commentary and criticism lately in the press just in the last couple of weeks. And I think for the photos on Pinterest, there are arguments both for and against fair use. pinning other people's photos onto a board, of course, is just another name for copying them. And Pinterest users generally don't ask permission, even if they do include attribution. It also allows the user to click through the board and see a full-size copy of the photo on Pinterest without having to go to the original site. And this gets at the problem of market effect. Having a full-size copy rather than just a smaller thumbnail may take away any reason to click through to the original site with its ads or whatever, and that looks like it's starting to substitute for the original. Pinterest users would have to argue they're curating the photos, that they're collecting and commenting or otherwise transforming them for using them for a different productive use. And, of course, that may be true in a lot of cases. On Pinterest, as in any kind of social media, there are a variety of uses, and some may be fair use and some may not. As I said about Chip's avatar, it depends. To me, Pinterest and avatars are good examples of how changes in technology that create new uses create changes in sort of the social norms of what's okay and what's acceptable in practice. It's highly unlikely, for the first place, that you would ever be sued for your avatar because no real harm comes from your use, and because I think it's become acceptable practice for people to use copyrighted images as avatars. So as custom becomes more widespread, it sort of bleeds into the law itself, shaping the law and being shaped by the law. Courts don't live in a vacuum, especially when it comes to things like fair use, which is based on equitable consideration. The fair use doctrine has a lot of gray areas, so it makes it hard to know ahead of time whether something is going to be fair use and be protected or not. But at the same time, those gray areas can give some breathing space for new uses and new technologies to be used in practice so that the norms of the community of practice can be a benefit to the users and, in some sense, protect users, at least until the law catches up. I think that's been true of a lot of the social media uses of remixing and user-generated content. And I think it may be true in time as well of a site like Pinterest.
All right. Thanks, Kathy. Any Pinterest users out there? Show of hands. Yeah, good number. Any of you live in fear of being shut down for copyright infringement? A few people. Yeah, there's been a lot going on, a lot of talk about that recently, and I'd like to hear your questions later as we wrap up this session, or as we go into our discussion portion of the session. But moving on, I'd like to move over to Tori Ekstrand. If you can't copyright a tweet, but suppose you're creating content that other people are using, what rights do you have? What incentives do news and other content creators have if copyright-type things aren't working for them?
Right. So I think we have this tweet I received recently.
So we got a tweet up.
Yeah.
This retweet
I received recently from a scholar friend at University of Virginia, and it made me think about the panel and about what I was going to address here, because this sort of represents another kind of claim that content creators think about when they're concerned about all of you out there reusing stuff. And that claim is what's known more commonly as the hot news doctrine or the hot news claim, and it's one that's come up in conversations. And unlike, and in courts, and unlike Kathy's discussion about copyright law, which really is talking about rights of property, photos or text as property, the hot news doctrine is talking about essentially the fairness issues between businesses. It's a part of unfair competition law. It's an unfair competition tort. So when I looked at this particular tweet, I said, well, this represents hot news. Hot news is that scoop upon which those of you, how many journalists out there or old-fashioned journalists? Okay, how many like bloggers out there? Okay, so you know, you get something new, you get something hot, you get a scoop, and you get picked up and you get tweeted and retweeted. This is good, right? We're excited about this. This is good and potentially can bring some revenue if you're running ads on your page or whatever. Traditionally, this idea of the hot news doctrine, which I think here is represented, this was a news piece about the ultrasound mandate that was passed by the Virginia Senate. This has some value. this hotness, right, of this information. People like, oh, it just happened. I'm going to retweet it. It has some value. And the court, the Supreme Court in particular, recognized this going back about 80, 90 years in a case called INS versus AP, International News Service versus the Associated Press. INS was taking, it was a Hearst-owned operation, it was routinely taking news from the AP news that was occurring. They were reporting from the front lines in World War I, and INS was taking this news. At the time of this particular case, going back, way back when, news was actually not routinely copyrighted. And so AP didn't have a lot of recourse to go after INS. It was just the practice at that time. You had to register your news, and it was sort of impossible to register news at that point. So AP took INS to court. Long story short, the Supreme Court gave AP and gave essentially all news providers a very limited right, property right of sorts, in the facts of news for a short period after publication. And that essentially is what the hot news doctrine is. Fast forward, obviously times have changed. News moves really quickly now in ways like this. And indeed, folks like Google in some recent hot news cases have argued that Twitter has really killed hot news. It's not possible, so says Google, for hot news to be that hot anymore, that we should actually give it some protection. I get that argument. But it doesn't, in my view, really mean it kills the business value. And indeed, it might even improve its value. And so I think there's sort of two key pieces here, just things that I've thought about in thinking about hot news in a social media context. First, Twitter does something, and social media do something that wasn't possible in INS times or going back to World War I, and that is we give credit, you know, on Twitter a lot of times, right? We give a link back to somebody else. And so when INS was taking news from AP, it was not giving AP any credit. And so I think to some extent, credit tends to deflate a hot news claim, though it doesn't entirely defeat it. I think the other piece that's sort of interesting to me as I think about hot news and social media is what really has developed over time here and concern about the hot news doctrine is this notion of people out on the web systematically and repeatedly taking timely news, timely information over and over and over. And here again, I'm talking about the most egregious of news aggregators out there. So to the extent that there are people out there completely scraping, completely aggregating in a rather sort of noticeable way, I think courts are recognizing and have indeed discussed and kept alive the hot news doctrine as a claim for content creators to wage. How much time do I have left?
You want to wrap, or you want to talk briefly about Barclays v. Flynn?
Yeah, so I guess the thing to talk about, because I think people, it's been interesting to sort of watch the conversation about this doctrine online, because it's very confusing, and that's represented in how people talk about it online. So is hot news dead? The answer to that is no. At least as far as the Second Circuit is concerned. The window for hot news claims still exists. It is very, very, very narrow. And I will personally say, as somebody who studies the free culture movement and who has serious concerns and interests in making sure that culture is shared online, I am not at all worried, really, about the hot news doctrine. The Fly case that occurred, the decision came down in the fall. The Fly was a flyonthewall.com is a website that took stock ratings before the market opened from some of the major banks and brokerage houses and used that on their site to their various clients, sold that to their various clients. The banks sued for copyright infringement and also for hot news, and Fly dropped its challenge to the copyright claims, and the firms were awarded some statutory damages for that. But the banks pursued the hot news claim on appeal to the Second Circuit. And the Second Circuit said, you know, this claim still survives, but the banks in this situation did not win their hot news claim. There are a series of factors plaintiff has to meet to make the claim and survive what's called copyright preemption. We can talk in more detail about kind of the specific legal pieces here. In ruling for FLY, the court said the doctrine was not essentially preempted by copyright. The court held that the FLY really did not free ride on the firm's work because it was out there collating and gathering the firm's recommendations at its own expense. It was going into chat rooms and pulling this information. And that's seriously what any news provider would do anyway. So I guess just to sum up quickly, the claim still survives. It's a very narrow, it's extremely difficult to prevail on a hot news claim. And it really has to look like, Riyadh and I were talking about this earlier, it really has to look like it did in the INS case. It really has to be more or less an egregious, and I would argue constant, scraping or taking of content for a plaintiff to prevail on a claim like that.
Right. So something well beyond a tweet or a retweet
yes.
of breaking news.
So with social media, you know, I mean, I don't think there are huge concerns here, but I think to the extent that a fly on the wall goes out and tweets about what it's doing, if it is indeed, you know, taking, scraping content, then yes, social media are implicated.
Okay. One of the things we've been talking about is business models and trying to find ways to deal with the copyright culture that is out there and the sharing culture and what that means for content creators and news content creators. And as you probably know, this has been a very challenging thing for the news industry to get its content paid for, particularly when there are curators and aggregators who may be taking or repurposing content and profiting from it. So one of the potential models, one of the models that's out there right now is one that Riyadh has been working with. You want to tell us a little bit about NewsRight?
Yeah, sure. Thanks. NewsRight started out as an initiative inside the Associated Press in 2009 that was focused on trying to address a particular problem. The problem was there is enormous consumption of news on all digital platforms. There's really every measure you take, the consumption of news is genuinely just enormous, and yet we're faced simultaneously with a certain kind of paradox. While this is happening, people who invest in the original in the creation of original news reporting seem to be having a very hard time of this. So you have a paradox, right? There's tremendous social consumption, tremendous social demand, and yet the people who create this valuable little bit closer, sure. Create this asset have appear not to be able to be compensated in the dominant paradigms that exist, and so you know we went about investigating and thinking about what are the underlying aspects of this, and one of the things that occurred to us, and I think that are brought up by the use case that Chip presented is. You know, you look at something like using a photo as an avatar, and you start asking yourself, is this fair use or not? And you run through and you look at it, and you can look at the various factors. And the reality is, it's pretty hard to analyze this in any value neutral way. And one of that is because they're again the same conundrum. There's no sustainable commercial status quo against which you can evaluate things like the effect of the market, and whether it's even transformative. I think one case that really highlights this for the news industry in particular is like the Perfect Ten, right? You have a case where, you know, perhaps it is the case that, you know, very, very small truncated versions of it was pornographic photos could not be a substitute for the full-size version of it, right? And you contrast that with the use of a news photo in which it's actually very normal to truncate the size of a news photo when you publish it in its native form. And so the syntax doesn't equal what's going on. It fair use genuinely is a factor test. And so when there's great flux in there's no existing status quo, commercial status quo, it's very hard. It becomes, in some cases, an inextricable conundrum. Another aspect to what we were doing was anything would require sort of a technology that could be scalable to the internet. So we invested AP and now Newswright invested in creating a technology that allows for scalable transactions, so that news publishers can make informed decisions about how their content is used on internet scale, which can only be done with automated analytics and only be done with automated transactions. And I think the last thing that we go into it thinking is that all the benefits, all the uses that consumers have, these are good things. The fact that people can share efficiently is a positive thing. The end users are not, there's nothing wrong with taking advantage of the benefits of that technology makes available. And really the focus has to be on underlying commercial aspects and focusing directly on those. We ended up spinning out. There was a spin out of it. There are 29 news organizations who are our investors. The spin out happened last July, and we're moving forward at this stage. To wrap up on just going on the use case that Chip was bringing up, very high level take on what's going on in this case is that you look at creating an avatar in this particular case, and you start comparing it to the a quid pro quo, which was once pretty normal, which is that you are an owner of original content, you have a platform, whether it was a traditional platform or now a digital platform, and the expectation you have associated with making that content available is that either you can get a subscription or you can deliver a commercial message and ad, a combination of both. And what is disrupted by that is where you have other platforms that interfere with the ability to deliver your commercial message for you to understand how it is that your content is being used. But that's the platform perspective. An individual sharing, an individual deciding to make, a fanciful use of a photo because they're trying to comment on, say, how their team is doing, that isn't that. And so, the perspective, now this is sort of an advocacy view, but the perspective of that isn't the kind of thing. It is not the kind of thing that news organizations should worry about.
All right. And how big is Newswright? How many employees do you have?
Well, we're currently in startup mode. So we have under 15 employees. We have 1,000 websites, and they're, pretty name brand, who are participants in it, in addition to the Associated Press, which is a for North America, a very significant news organization, and we're adding publishers, every week.
All right. We'll be glad to talk a little bit more about that and some of the challenges that brings up for republishing as well. Now for something completely different, or at least a little bit different. We've mostly been talking copyright sorts of things. What I'd like to bring up is some trademark issues. Anybody familiar with at BP Global PR? I followed this pretty heavily last year, and still do. Great site. This was it's a mock Twitter account, and you probably follow or have seen any number of them if you followed Rahm Emanuel and other folks. There are regular people who get mocked. You have celebrities who get mocked. You have politicians who get mocked. You get businesses who get mocked. And while there are terms and conditions issues that come up with this on Twitter, Facebook, other places, there are also some legal issues that come up with that. And what I'd like to do briefly is talk about e-personation and trademark dilution. For businesses, I'm starting with businesses, I think it's easier for businesses to deal with this because they have such strong trademark protection these days. I actually think BP could have gone after and shut down BP Global PR on trademark dilution cases if they wanted to. I think it was a strategic decision not to. In fact, as far as I understand, they tried to buy out the writer and get him to come write for them, kind of mock him on their own, and he refused and started selling T-shirts, which, is wonderful. But in terms of use of the logo, use of the actual name, and holding themselves out as, if you look at their identifier as public relations for BP Global, they do not say, at one point he said fake or a parody. I think he's even taken that down. I think he probably, that BP could take them down. It's just a matter of, is it worth their effort and the bad PR they would get for it to try to take down a public commenter during such a bad time? So, and the Trademark Dilution Act, which was strengthened in favor of trademark holders after the Victoria's Secret case, which was famous or infamous, depending on your perspective. They shut down Victor's Little Secret, a lingerie and adult entertainment store in Kentucky. It made them change it to Kathy's Little Secret. After Victor Mosley and his wife won at the Supreme Court level, the lobbyists came and changed the law, and then Victoria's Secret won the next round of cases, saying that, well, Victor's Little Secret is way too close to Victoria's Secret, and there might be some harm or confusion, so Victor Mosley, you lose. You can go look at kathyslittlesecret.com on your own time if you like. I made the mistake of just pulling, or actually I had students present it in class one time and link to the site, and just had to cover my eyes and shake my head. So I think businesses have pretty strong protection to protect their trademarks. It's really more their option of whether they want to go after it or not, and how close it is. Do they actually use the logo or the name or those sorts of things? Well, what about people? If you're a celebrity, you are, say, a baseball manager. By the way, this is an exhibit from a court document. Tony La Russa sued, brought a lawsuit against this former manager of the Cardinals, brought a lawsuit against Twitter and the user who created, kind of the earlier days of Twitter, a fake Tony La Russa account. It was not at fake Tony La Russa. By the way, that does exist now. You can go see that. It was at Tony La Russa. And it had quotes and comments that were really pretty offensive, even for those to admit who are still disappointed that they got crushed by them in the World Series last year. Tony La Russa was not amused and sued. And ultimately, Twitter took the account down. They ended up settling and making this stop. Celebrities have a right under what we call a privacy tort of appropriation to protect their image and likeness from being used in a commercial way without their permission. And fake Twitter accounts would probably fall under there. That said, if it's not for commercial purposes and it's not really harming them, I think they don't have quite as good of a case. You do fall into First Amendment protected parody. I think for politicians, fake Rahm Emanuel and others, they're not going to have any claim at all. The First Amendment is going to protect political speech in that way. But what about regular people? You and me, and somebody comes up and creates a fake Facebook account or Twitter account about us and starts talking about who we're sleeping around with or our hygiene habits or other things we've done. And yes, this happens as often when relationships go bad. There's a recent case in New Jersey where this very much happened. A police officer was being just mocked and relentlessly abused by an ex-girlfriend or spouse, I forget. Well, he sued under New Jersey's online or just regular impersonation laws, kind of stalking and harassment, and was going to prevail under those. Nevertheless, New Jersey was looking to add a criminal online impersonation act. Several states already have these. The one we're in now, Texas, does have an online impersonation act. New York does. I read earlier today that Washington does as well. The broadest is, I believe, in California, which had its e-personation law go into effect last year. And I think it extends both to regular people and celebrities, but makes it a misdemeanor, so punishable by jail time and fines, to, without consent, credibly impersonate another actual person for me, purpose of harming, intimidating, threatening, or defrauding them. And harm is a very broad thing. You can harm people in a lot of ways besides financially. You can harm them psychologically. And I think that the courts are going to review this and have to make a determination. Is it too vague to survive constitutional scrutiny or not? It'll be interesting to see how these cases are applied and prosecuted. With that, I think that's all that I have on my agenda to talk about, but I'm sure you have lots of questions. What I'd like to do, if you would get up and speak into the mic, that way the podcast can hear us, and come up with your questions. We're glad to answer the best we can. The line is forming.
So going back to your original slide about the Texas Rangers, you know, the guys had the bags on their head. What if you had a photo that was just the players and then you decided to alter it and put bags on their heads and then put it on your blog? Is that fair use or is that infringement?
I have my answer, but I think Kathy may be the expert on this. What do you think?
Well, I think you can argue that you've then transformed it, that, you know, you're making it sort of comment and criticism if you're putting the bags on their heads, you know, to comment on their performance. But you've certainly changed the original and made it into something new in a way that I think, you know, you could easily argue would be transformative. You know, that's not the whole picture for fair use, but I think, you know, that's an even stronger argument for fair use than the picture that Chip had. You know, I didn't get into the factors on that one, but making it smaller because of the Perfect 10 case, even though you're using an entire photo, if you're making it smaller for something like a news photo, you know, I think you can argue that it doesn't affect the market. There's not a market for such a small photo. And so that would go toward fair use for you as well. So, but certainly how you've changed the facts, I think, makes it an even stronger case.
And, of course, that's a lawyer's recommendation, right, and a piece of advice. And I think one of the frustrations for ordinary folks out on the web using social media is, you know, with making a fair use analysis, Larry Lessig says, you know, fair use is your right to hire a lawyer and go to court. You know, you don't really know if it's a fair use until the moment you step in a courtroom necessarily. You've just gotten terrific legal advice from Dr. Kathy Olson here, and I would agree with it. But I think one of the frustrations for the users sitting in this audience, right, and the users out there generally, is that, one, we sort of know fair use, we don't know fair use. But secondly, you know, we don't really know until we step into a courtroom. And that is the frustration for the vast majority of users out on the web.
And courts have been all over the place. I'd mentioned in kind of the teaser for this that the Righthaven litigation, which was you know, what we call copyright trolls, they went up and bought a bunch of copyrights to basically a right to sue against a number of news organization or uses of news organization photos, and they failed across the board on things I would have said were probably not fair use. Taking full scrapes, full copies of articles and putting them on a blog is pretty much a full taking, a scrape. Righthaven lost that case. That was deemed to be fair use. And I think it was judges just didn't like Righthaven. But either way, it certainly protected citizens in those types of uses. By the way, on the side, I that's a great idea, and I would like to take some particular rangers and Photoshop some bags on their heads and use them in the future. So I much appreciate. There's a couple I have in mind from Game 6 last year. I know I shouldn't even mention it. I'm going to need a drink after this. Next up.
So you were talking about how tweets are not commonly able to be copyrighted. But how about in cases of something like transmedia storytelling, where you're telling like an entire story over multiple tweets, mm-hmm. or that is part of a bigger storytelling experience? What would the copyright on that? Is that possible to copyright?
Yeah, it's interesting because while individual tweets are, you know, basically too short to be copyrightable, compilations of tweets can be copyrighted. Compilations of things that the underlying thing isn't copyrightable may be copyrightable if there's sufficient creativity put into how you arranged it, the tweets that you chose. So I think your example would be something like that. I don't know that I haven't read it, but the book Shit My Father Says, right, is a book of tweets. And so that in of itself, taking, you know, individual units, if you will, that aren't on their own copyrightable because of the creativity of the arrangement and the selection, can make something copyrightable.
Very good. Yes, next question.
Yeah, I have a question about usernames on the social media. So let's say my name is Brad Pitt, and I want to have a Twitter account called Brad Pitt. Or my name is Chip Stewart, two different examples, and I want to have the Chip Stewart account. What law governs the resolution of who actually gets priority on that particular handle?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think some of it's going to fall because you can't really trademark names of celebrities that well. You may get in some unfair competition or appropriation areas, but that's
Blue Ivy, right? Although they tried, like with Blue Ivy, right?
Yeah, they certainly have tried. And it kind of depends on what kind of celebrity you are, too. I remember last year both Bristol and Sarah Palin tried to trademark their own names, mm-hmm. and I think Bristol has a better argument for her celebrity purposes than a politician could under for political speech purposes. But yeah, I can't stop other, and I've tried. No, I haven't tried. But I can't stop other Chip Stewarts from taking the at Chip Stewart name, and I don't think Brad Pitt could stop you. I wonder if there are some anti-cyber squatting laws that are out there intended to be for domain names, for URLs. And while they're not specifically written, I mean, these things were written 10 years ago. They were not specifically written anticipating Twitter. I could see a parallel being drawn from that to this area. If I were to bring that lawsuit, that's probably how I would go about it. I do not think there's a whole lot of protection beyond trademark or regular appropriation that would prevent you from doing that. Good question. Next.
So I have some questions from the other side. Right. So I wrote in 1981, I wrote a book called Winning Isn't Normal. And
yeah, could you speak up a little bit, please?
Yeah, in 1981, I wrote a book called Winning Isn't Normal. And there's a section in that book called Winning Isn't Normal. That's basically the essence of the book. It's a very short book, about 64 pages, but this takes up about one page. Right? And I am familiar with the Gerald Ford case. Right? But it's been disseminated all over the world, and it started off by coaches doing it and handing it out to athletes who would hand it out and become coaches and hand it out, et cetera, et cetera. Well, the advent of the internet allowed me to discover that this thing was all over the world that I never knew before. So that was great on that one hand. But on the other hand, there become increasingly ways of that being distributed, increasing means. So, for example, in 2010, somebody posted it on his blog. Well, let me back up. Somebody got it from someone who posted it on his blog, who got it from a coach, who had gotten it from a book in which it was stolen. Anyway, this guy posted it on his blog. Somebody else posted it on his blog and got 10,000 hits on it within 3 days. From there, people started tweeting it. Some of them would copy it, post it to the original poster, right? Two steps back, not one. Many of them back to the one step, and on and on, and it's just gone on from there. Some of the problems that I have with it is, first of all, very few of them give me any attribution. And so now we have an issue of it appears to be in the public domain, but it's not. Even worse, some people post it as anonymous or author unknown. Right. And so it's been in, you know, 7 or 8 books, and I can go after those people. But what about Twitter, tweets, and, you know, how do I...
So how would you, if someone is, I'm just kind of rephrasing this for the panel, your copyrights have already been violated or at least challenged, you know, through dissemination on the web in other places. What if people are tweeting links to it or other ways to get to it? So using social media or sharing on social media, say on Facebook, they just attach it. What are your rights there? I think a lot is going to come back to whether it's fair use in the first place or not. Hyperlinking and tweeting to something, I think, would certainly be protected and would not be would qualify as fair use or would just not be would not create a claim for you at all. But I think a lot's going to underlie the original creation. What do y'all think?
I don't know. Is there no contributory infringement there? I mean, if people are repeatedly infringing this gentleman's content around the web, by the way, are you pursuing?
Am I what?
Are you pursuing any actions against
Yes.
these people who are, okay.
Yes.
You know, but if they're repeatedly, I think this is an unanswered question. As far as I know, maybe Riad or Kathy know more, but to the extent that people then retweet infringing content, could that be a claim for contributory infringement?
Yeah, I mean, there's actually a case going on now, with a freelance photographer who posted pictures that he took of the earthquake in Haiti on Twitter, or TwitPic, and another user copied his photos, put them on his account, and sort of claimed them as his own. And from there, AFP, the Agence France-Presse, took those photos and distributed them, and they were on CNN and CBS and the Boston Globe. So the original, the photographer who has the copyright in them, is pursuing claims against all of those news outlets. And sort of what's sort of striking to me is that AFP claimed they had the right to use the photos because the photographer had put them on Twitter. And the judge said, no, that's not true, right? Because you put something on Twitter, it doesn't become part of the public domain. I know that's not your issue because you didn't tweet it, right? Right. People have tweeted it after you. But as far as, contributory infringement, that the agency helped others infringe, that claim, I believe, is still going forward. So I think there is some precedent for that.
I don't
that.
Think we have answers there yet, but I would imagine we're going to get some. So, I don't know if Riyadh.
The way the world is currently set up is it's very, very challenging for people who are for content owners to protect their rights. The simple scale of it, scale of internet, what it takes to have an effective enforcement program, and even around completely uncontroversial topics, right, is daunting. In many, many cases, you're going to have people who have no ability to pay, right, judgment-proof defendants, or you're going to have intermediaries who can take advantage of DMCA, which means that they are essentially indifferent to whether they're supporting infringing activities or not. It is hard. Doctrinally, under certain circumstances, if you do a full program, there are DMCA remedies ostensibly for linking, but you have to have a pretty sophisticated program for that. It is genuinely tough.
And I would think some of this would come to, in terms of what would Twitter's responsibility be for this, it's probably in their terms and conditions. They already say users are not supposed to use things in this way, and they are disclaiming any responsibility for it. And also, the proper remedy would be used under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act to do a takedown, to say, stop circulating this. And I'm not saying that's going to exactly satisfy you or get you any money, but that's the system we've got right now.
So I
would like to – do you have a final statement?
Just one follow-up question, because it's a huge issue, I think, in this area, which is jurisdiction, which is the it's one thing for me to go after someone who – I live in Texas, right? Go after someone right. who's in Texas, or if I bought a book in Texas, which is – that has infringed upon mine. But – when it's being Twittered all over, Twitter or Facebook or, everywhere else in the world, the harm is clearly here.
Right.
But you comment about jurisdiction there at all?
Real briefly, jurisdiction is a mess on internet issues. You're still talking about usually bringing copyright infringement claims in federal court in the district of the user, of the reposter. So that the infringer is usually where the natural jurisdiction is. I'm not sure if home jurisdictions have gotten a lot of protection or you've been able to bring lawsuits in your jurisdiction rather than somebody else's. Do any of y'all know? Have you seen cases like that for social uses or even blog uses? I can't think of anything that you start to get into federal civil procedure at that point and jurisdictional issues, and that's another topic for another time. But I think it's I do agree that I don't think that's fair at all. That puts a huge burden on content creators to enforce something in a very difficult way, to go and find out whether what they've done is protectable or not.
It's not a question, but listening to you might make a comment about fair use as an affirmative defense rather than as permission to use.
Yeah, that would be a good way of thinking about things. That's a very interesting way of thinking about things. Okay, next question, please.
My question is about Flipboard, which is a news reader that sort of scrapes the news articles from websites, and it cleans them up. It pulls out the ads. You don't see the ads. You just see the text, and you see the images. Is it, in your opinion, are they doing something illegal? And if not, how far would they have to take it to be doing something illegal?
Actually, we'll probably throw that one over to Riyadh. Yeah. What do you think about a group like Flipboard?
Well, you know, they're interesting cases. I mean, that organization, I mean, judging from the outside, so they actually do enter into license relationships with a lot of their partners, and they're explicit on that on that regard. That isn't to say that some activities. So let me just use a more generalized term. Not every kind of personal viewing app like that does enter into it, and some aspects of Flipboard might be more like that. So you know, they have a whole set of publisher relationships which are explicit. There are a lot of apps that do not do that, and they will have substantial use of third-party content. They will remove commercial messages, and they will disintermediate the relationship between the content owner who created that content and the end user. Often the quid pro quo for the end user is to give up a substantial amount of his or her privacy in connection with that, in the hopes that at someday they'll be able to effectively commercialize that personal information. That is it's a pretty common paradigm right now.
All right. Another question?
Yes, hi. I'm curious about the interplay between the First Amendment and trademark dilution, such as with the BP Global PR, where you've got valid social criticism, you know, public criticism taking place. It's in a framework of satire,
right?
Such as in the Falwell case, or if there's just, you know, absence of malice, like with New York Times v. Sullivan. It seems like the dilution statute is about claiming a injury to reputation, just as defamation is. Has there been any thought on how that applies to dilution?
Yeah, there's actually been a number of court cases. By the way, I haven't mentioned, we've talked a few court cases in here, like the Perfect 10 case and some others. Those are all in our slides in our on the Tumblr I put together. There's links to the cases and some comments on them as well. So, you know, we lawyers start talking about cases as if everybody knows them sometimes. So our apologies if we're using case names they're not familiar. But you can click through our Tumblr and see that. But yeah, there are a number of trademark dilution cases, and you've really hit the difficult issue, which is at what point does blurring, tarnishment, or other sorts of things happen to a trademark that they have a right to protect against, and at what point are you getting into constitutionally protected free speech and parody? And there are cases from the 60s, 70s, 80s. One of my favorites involved the Enjoy Coke. You probably remember the Coke kind of swirl, the colors, and there was the poster in the 70s, Enjoy Coke. Well, somebody transformed it and said, Enjoy Cocaine. And Coca-Cola was not amused by the story and was selling posters about it. And I'm pretty sure they won that one on dilution grounds. They said, yeah, that's a commentary or a criticism, but that still hurts us. You're not trying to create a likelihood of confusion. You're just hurting our mark. You're degrading our mark. And those protections have become stronger over time, not weaker. And that's why I think that if BP moved forward, I'm not saying that I totally agree with that. I think that there should be a greater grounds for First Amendment free expression here. But dilution has become easier for companies to win after the 2005 revisions to the Federal Trademark Dilution Act.
But wouldn't a defense to BP be, you know, I've tarnished your mark compared to what you've already done?
Right, yes. Yeah, exactly.
Libel-proof plaintiff.
Exactly, yeah. The unclean hands in a very literal way defense.
So before I ask my actual question, I'm wondering if you guys have noticed what I think is kind of a really funny trend on YouTube of people posting videos that are clearly not theirs, like music videos for major record labels, and in the description it just says, fair use, no copyright infringement intended.
Yes, I've noticed that.
Yes, I've seen that a lot.
And a lot of that comes in response to the automated systems they have and in response to some pretty heavy-handed litigation efforts by the music industry to take those things down and sue based on them.
I mean, I understand that, but at the same time, it's like, but it is, you are copyright
infringing. Yeah, definitely
it is. You didn't intend it, but you did.
But isn't it is sort of interesting how, you know, the culture is sort of trying to drive a conversation about that, though, in a way. I mean, legally, it has no bearing, right? But that's not going to stop people from driving the conversation about trying to, you know, change how it is we do this, right?
Right, yeah.
So my actual question, I have a friend who runs a relatively popular local blog. It's his business. It's his only source of income. And a post that he'd done got picked up and a photo was reposted on Gawker. And there was a link back to his website, but, you know, it was a full-size image. And certainly it didn't have his advertising when it was on Gawker. And so he was very upset and he, you know, demanded that they take it down, and they said, no, it's fair use. And so to me, that seems very clear that it's not, because they are infringing on his market and his ability to make money off of it. So I'm wondering about that as a business model, because there's so many blogs that do that, not just Gawker, that, you know...
There are,
do you think that will continue?
There are. There are a number. I mean, at AP, one of the areas that I was sort of in charge of for a while was the images, and there is a very active plaintiff's bar protecting them, photographers, and there are bloggers that are all but hell-bent on using other people's photos, making money off of them, and figuring out how to use DMCA, changing IP addresses, as long as possible to avoid paying any licensing fee whatsoever. So that's a real phenomenon.
And there's an ongoing case we talked about before, the Meltwater case. The AP's actually brought a lawsuit against a pretty, you know, full-on aggregator, right?
Yeah, that is... you know, it's a different phenomenon than the bloggers.
The Gawker,
I mean, there's some famous bloggers, and they're pretty famous, who refuse to license. So litigation is the only option. There's a different kind of phenomenon, which is aggregation, and it's automated, largely automated aggregation, and even industrial scale aggregation ends up involving some manual aspects. Automated aggregation, and then sale of it as a service. So you would imagine, think of it more like a, you know, Google News, Google Alerts, but with very specified tools that are useful to information workers that allow them more flexibility than you would have with some of the free ones. So they charge a fee for it. Mm-hmm. They develop none of their own content. Some of them also allow the equivalent of like archiving and use of the full text as part of it. Oftentimes there is some nod to the "I'm just going to use a snippet" and a link back to the original source as well, under this sort of thinking that I can come up with a syntactic definition of fair use, like I'm just going to use a little bit. In the news industry, and just focusing, I mean, there's a couple of things where I think it, you know, talk about, like this idea of making an image small and thinking that that automatically makes it transformative, but that doesn't have an adverse effect. And, you know, Perfect 10, again, was focusing on pornographic images.
Right.
And maybe you could say, like, a little thumbnail, it couldn't possibly be a substitute for the full-size version for the intended purpose of pornographic images. When you get to news ones, it's certainly not so simple. Truncations are actually the normal. If you actually look at the file size of an original news photograph, it's enormous, right? There was also a gentleman who talked about, well, what if I changed some color schemes or did a little bit that too? Understood against the backdrop is there's an entire community of professional photographers that rely in commercial context. So maybe on your blog, it's one thing. What if you started selling handbags with that exact same image? What if you started selling baseball caps, hoodies, this sort of thing? And that, you know, recognizing that the blogger or the person using it might not realize that there's actually a whole industry where photographers survive on income derived from that. So.
Right.
Although certainly Gawker realized.
Yeah, Gawker would think that. They would have to know, yeah. We're actually just about out of time. What I'd like to do is invite people to come forward with more questions or tweet them at me or our panel. We'll be glad to answer them. This has been a terrific experience for us. I hope you've enjoyed it as well. If you would, I wrote an article last year on using photos for news purposes, and they gave me all these off prints from the law journal, so come and take them because I don't want them. You're welcome to have them. Otherwise, they'll probably get recycled. We got some business cards and things, too, so you're welcome to come and visit with us. But thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you.